Okay. So we'll start with a nice Santa Fe wall. A lot of what I'm going to talk about in some of the beginning, I have sort of two topics. One is a little bit about sort of some of the ground state for sexual behavior in the human population. I'll be dealing mostly with normative male-female. So there's a wide range of stuff, but sort of what the literature has come to say about what is true for the human species. A lot of this is taken from a book by Matt Ridley called The Red Queen, which actually is taken from Alice in Wonderland, and the concept that the evolution of sexual behavior in most mammalian species, other species, and in ourselves is based on essentially this whole, what's been called an arms race between bacteria and parasites and us and sexual selection and the passing down of positive gene traits and and basically selecting into what's a more successful group of progeny, basically working for grandchildren. And the whole concept of the Red Queen, and the Red Queen is important, is that you have to run as fast as you can to stay in the same place. Remember that line from Alice in Wonderland. And so one of the pieces I want to leave you with here about how the DNA and the genes code for sexuality is that this is an incredible dynamic tension between ourselves as an organism, the information system in the DNA that codes for us, all those other organisms out there that are either going to see us as prey or as predator. And we were a prey species long, long, long before we became the top predator species that we are now. And that tension is also exhibited in terms of the issues around what happens in sex in human beings. And I think Diane brought this up early on in terms of talking about my daughter and what she was all upset about. And I think this is actually a very important statement. Sex as an interaction is a very asymmetric relationship. The consequences of the sex act for males are minuscule. 15 to 30 minutes of aerobic effort, a little bit of oxytocin and endorphin, and then out the door. Thank you very much. Bye bye. That's in contrast for the female, where the sex act is fraught with peril. Up until the advent of modern obstetrics, the mortality rate for women during childhood and pregnancy was 30%. Okay, so just like we were talking earlier today about, their 25 to 30% of the males met their death via murder and warfare, in the pre.
Or 15% generally.
Enough.
Enough. Yeah. Enough. Definitely.
15 to 30% of the males met their death in murder. 15 to 35% of the women died in childbirth, because. We also talked earlier about this tremendous growth in the size of the cranium, and even though we have restricted our species has restricted the development of the size of the head to a very small amount at birth, and most of that growth in the size, even in the number of neurons and the size of the brain, happens outside the womb after delivery, we're still dealing with just about the maximum size of pelvis that a woman can have to deliver a head that size. And I look at myself in the mirror every morning and I say, thank God for my mother. And I apologize daily. This is a 61 centimeter circumference skull.
There is a correlation between the size of the head and the size of the volume of the brain.
Thank you. I appreciate that. But we're actually at the maximum deliverable size for an infant skull going through the pelvis that is capable of walking. The pelvis any wider in the female, and she could not walk without literally being completely unsteady. And for those women who are in the audience who have carried children to term, that last trimester, when all the sutures in your pelvis begin to kind of loosen and spread apart so that the pubic symphysis is no longer like this, but it's sort of like that, and you begin to feel that instability of gait, you begin to understand exactly what I'm talking about. So here is this kind of very asymmetric process that occurs. Now, so there is, in a relationship, in the sexual relationship, a very dynamic tension between the male role and the female role. Both individuals are, because of the way that our DNA has coded for us, both individuals are absolutely engaged in the process of making sure that that DNA is replicated in the next two or three generations. That's part of the drive to do this. So there is an innate structure of behavior that says we are a sexual species. This is the way we procreate. This is the way we reproduce. You're going to have to do that. But because of the differences in the costs of sex and procreation to the male and the female, there are markedly different things. So let me talk a little bit about some of the evolution of that. About 3 million years ago, the hominid lineage split into two or more. Then the original ape man probably had to do fruits and seeds, which became increasingly rare. The other line, which came to us, the animals known as Homo, took to a diet of meat. By 1.6 million years ago, when Homo sapiens was living in Africa, he was without question the most carnivorous monkey or ape the world had ever known. To hunt, or even more, to seek lion kills and steal them for the tribe, required a man to range farther from home and to rely on his companions for coordinated help. So for the shape of the skull began to retain more juvenile shape into adulthood, a bigger brain, a smaller jaw, maturity is gradually delayed so that children grew slowly into adulthood and depended on their parents longer. And then for about a million years, people lived in a way that couldn't have changed very much. They were in grasslands and savannas, first in Africa and later in Asia, eventually in Australasia and the Americas. They hunted animals for food, gathered fruits and seeds, and were highly social within each tribe, hostile toward members of the other tribe. They probably lived in small bands. They were perhaps nomadic. They presumably shared the features that are universal among modern humans of all cultures: a pair bond as an institution in which to rear children, romantic love, jealousy, and sexually induced male-male violence, a female preference for men of high status, a male preference for young females, warfare between bands, and so on. There was certainly a sexual division of labor between hunting men and gathering women, something unique to human beings and a few birds of prey. So there's some real similarities, actually, in terms of the way that birds organize this. So this best environmental adaptation, because when we go back, I think I talked about this earlier, agriculture is 10,000 years old. It happened after the cessation of the last ice age, when we entered actually into what's been a relatively climactic stable point and you could count on crops. Before, you could gather grain, but the growing season was so erratic and the rainfall patterns were so erratic that it was impossible to predict whether or not there was going to be rain on this patch of ground next year, which has not been true for the last 10,000 years. Relatively stable ecosystem may not be true in the next 10,000 years, thank you very much. But, you know, that's one of the things. So in this adaptation, the most critical feature of that adapted era is other people. Our brains grew so big not to make tools, but to psychologize one another. The lesson of socioecology is that our mating system is determined not by ecology, but by other people, members of the same gender, and members of the other gender. So where this winds up, if you look at some interesting things, is first off, in a lot of agricultural things, that there was a great deal of polygamy. So that in highly stratified Oriental societies of early history, people would seem to behave exactly as you would expect them if they knew that their goal on earth was to leave as many descendants as possible. Men tend to seek polygamy. Women strove to marry upward with men of high status. So the interesting thing that happened there was that you had all of these, all single male would have multiple wives, and there's a whole litany of cultural analysis where this is true. What that actually made sure of, one, is that a whole lot of men did not have progeny. And so it was the chiefs who passed on most of what was going on. There's this interesting statistic, if you look at the Y chromosome analysis, 40% of the men in Asia from Shanghai to the eastern city limit of Moscow have the Y chromosome of Genghis Khan. I mean, and so that gives you an idea about what happens in that kind of culture. That one male, or somebody in his immediate lineage, left an imprint on the male aspect of the culture that extends to just a tremendous number of folks. So where does this wind up? And this is kind of a cynical conclusion. Because the other piece that came up, monogamy, is actually a product of democracy. Is actually a product when you no longer have that same kind of hierarchy. So you see, the Christian church in Europe during the last 2,000 years was quite happy to deal with essentially polygamy. You would have one wife who was the queen, and then you'd have multiple other mistresses with whom you would have children, but they would be the bastards who would basically be left out, and there'd be a certain amount of money that would be sent to them. The church was quite happy with that. They just basically started outlawing when all the guys who had been displaced from the kings wound up in the monasteries, and they said, "Hey, we want to make sure that we inherit that the church at least gets all this money." So then it was a power struggle over things. Now, so that's the male side is polygamy. What about the power situation? And it turns out that in societies, relatively stable societies, that if you go and look at the actual genetic inheritance, and this has been done in Liverpool, it's been done in some of communities in Liverpool, it's been done in other places in England. I think there's even one of these studies was done on an apartment building in the Upper East Side. So it appears to be independent of and across cultures. And you go and you look and see who are the as you do the genomic analysis, and you find out, and you do the chromosome analysis, and you find out who's inherited to whom. Who is the son or daughter of whom? And you look at stable pair bonds. Somewhere around 20% of the children of stable relationships without any defined history of adultery, 20% of the children of those pair bonds are not descended from the male half. Very interesting, as the old Saturday Night Live joke used to say. So what's going on here? It turns out that you have two different kinds of males that tend to be selected by the women, and that the actual choice for having progeny, the actual choice in this matter resides in the woman and not in the male. You know, if you look at marriage proposals in multiple cultures, marriage proposals, the male proposes to the woman gets to say yes or no. She's the one who has the final say on whether she's going to invest that much of her body and that risk to her life in the decision to procreate and have children. Okay. So what you have is a situation where the woman will tend to want to bond lifetime with a Bob Newhart type. And I've been told multiple times, so I'm going to do it right now. Okay. My physiognomy gets cut. Do you know you look like Bob Newhart? This happens in my office about twice a week. So you have the Bob Newhart type who is basically the stable, compassionate, going to be there for the kids, raise them, guaranteed to make sure that the progeny will reach adulthood. And then you have the Sylvester Stallone type, who is going to come in, do his thing, and leave and leave the raising of the children to others. And this, to some extent, is testosterone fueled, but to some extent, it's probably genetic programming. Then you go and you look at studies where women look at faces and rate them on an assessment of sexual attractiveness, and you rate them in terms of their cycle. You sample the women in terms of their menstrual cycle. And what's very interesting is that Bob Newhart wins day one of the menstrual cycle up to about day 10. Sylvester Stallone happens day 10 to about day 15 or 16. And then Bob Newhart shows back up on day 17 through 24. Fascinating. What's the problem here? When do you ovulate? Day 14. In addition, There's also data to suggest that when women have adulterous affairs, they are much more likely to be impregnated by their paramour than they are by their husband in the same period of time. So you have a situation where the women are, because ovulation is largely hidden from the woman and largely hidden from the male in the relationship, it's only when you start doing this real timing and you start doing an analysis and go back and really dig that you begin to see that there are some subtle cues here, that you realize that the woman is pair bonded with the male who will make sure that his children are reared and carried on, but she has a certain percentage, not every woman, I'm not going to say that, but a significant percentage of women will have outside the relationship flings, which they are much more likely to bear progeny through and will carry on the highly testosterone, relatively aggressive, neglectful, the sociopath dude that I was talking about earlier today, who's going to make sure that gene gets carried on in the gene pool. And this is a little bit independent of the morality of the whole situation. But if you stand back and look at it from the perspective of the DNA needs to have its DNA copied into the next two or three or four generations, it begins to make sense. It begins to say that for the health of this whole genetic clan, okay, this 200-member clan that we talked about in the African savanna, for the health and survival of that clan, these all need to be occurring. You need to have the dudes who are going to bring home the antelope and make sure that it's shared and make sure that their progeny are raised to adulthood and it shows some compassion. You need the guys to go out and kill the antelope and to protect you against the tribe on the clan on the next in the next valley. And that essentially looks like how this thing is organized. So we spent a whole afternoon here starting with morality and compassion. Now I've thrown this one at you. That these are the issues that you actually have to confront in terms of our behavior in regard to sex and love. So let's move on a little bit from that to another thing, romantic love. Romantic love and pair bonding is an area where we've actually begun to get some imaging technology that really shows what's going on. Romantic love is a mammalian brain system for mate choice. You have a display producer, and you have a display chooser. Display producers in other species, for example, are antlers on deer, the peacock feathers, which totally destabilize a peacock and make it almost very difficult to fly. They have a cost and viability, and the way that they state, I am sufficiently strong in terms of my general nature that I can expend all of this useless energy. Okay. In buying a Ferrari, which is where it starts to show in men. I can expend all this useless energy in male-to-male combat and primacy issues and making sure that my salary is higher than everybody else's and I can do the entire Wall Street number so that then I am a much more suitable male to be selected for mating. The brain mechanisms of courtship attraction or romantic love are characterized by increased energy, focused attention, obsessive following, affiliative gestures, possessive mate guarding, motivation to win a preferred mating partner. A number of things start to sound very dharmic in there. You know, increased energy, focused attention, something of an obsessive following, returning back and back and back to the breath. There's some overflow from that's quite interesting. There's also a time course to this in romantic love. The intense early stage romantic love lasts about 12 to 18 months. And then in the people who've been studied, it tends to fade. So romantic love is characterized by choice. The strength is determined by symptoms, reciprocation or rejection. There's an interesting issue of age of the lover. It tends to be younger women, older men. Time of first appearance is puberty. It is generally strongest in adolescence, generally weaker with adults, interfered with by lust, and affected by general intelligence. I'm not sure which way. I think intelligence is more interfered with by romantic love. So, let's look at Let's look at an article by Helen Fisher, who's done some of the work on here. Well, first one thing. There, in that choice of mate, there are cold choosers who basically respond to sort of any ornamental body part. That's largely insects. And then there's hot choosers, where animals whose choice of mates has pleasure associated with it. The hot choosers in the animal models have been studied in humans. That's run by dopamine. And dopamine changes in the nucleus accumbens really influence their choice of mate. If you have the prairie vole, which is a model for monogamy, the nucleus accumbens lights up when they're with their chosen mate. If you block dopamine, it'll drop that mate. It'll go pick on somebody else. If you use a dopamine agonist, it'll choose the mate that's present when the drug is given. So it takes the selection process. It's sort of like dopamine shows up and, oh, I guess you must be the cause. Hi. And human romantic love is very universal. It appears to be a biologic issue. They looked at 166 cultures, found romantic love in 147 of them, and when they went back and looked at the anthropology of this, the anthropologists forgot to ask in the other 19 cultures. So there's no data on those. The individuals regarded as special. It's involuntary. It's difficult to control. It's impermanent. It just shows up. So this is something which you're taken over. It literally boils up from the brainstem. You maximize the positive traits of the beloved. You minimize the flaws, the famous comment of love being blind. You literally don't see them. Those issues in the in your mirror neuron system, it stops registering what's happening on the other side. There's a separation anxiety. There's an emotional dependence. There's an intrusive obsessional thinking. It bears a great deal of resemblance to psychiatric diseases. So, Fisher and Aaron and Brown did a study on functional MRI imaging on 17 subjects. Using the photograph of the beloved, altering with a neutral picture, and then there was a distraction task in between those two pictures. The result shows, and actually I brought up the wrong thing here, so let me go and get that. The result shows that in the ventral tegmental, which is A, which is an area down in the upper brainstem, which is a region of A10 dopamine cells and really deeply involved in the circuit of the reward system, that lights up when the beloved picture is in the field of view. So this is involved. This system is evolved in animal studies in arousal, focused attention, motivation to pursue, and acquire rewards. Interesting, here we go. And it projects to the head of the caudate, which is a basal ganglia nucleus, which has a role in reward detection and expectation, representation of goals, and an integration of sensory inputs to prepare for action. This lights up when you're romantically involved. This is confirmed in another study by Bartels and Zecht, who looked at 17 subjects. Their duration of in love was about 28.8 months. They also found the ventral tegmentum and the caudate. And it's been subsequently found in very, very long-term pair bonds, that this area remains lit in people who are out there 20 and 25 years, who still report that they're very much in love with their other. So this appears to be the neural substrate for being with your soulmate forever and ever and ever, from a basal ganglia brainstem kind of affair. Now, what happens in... Now there is another thing that begins to happen as you move out it from that 12 month into the 28 months, which is other areas begin to light up in regards to the picture of the beloved. Cortex begins to show up, the right mid-occipital, the middle temporal, the cingulate cortex, all of this storytelling, I, me, mine begins to happen. Interestingly enough, the right hypothalamus and the right sensory motor and premotor cortex begins to happen. So it appears to be that as we go into a more permanent pair bond, we begin to have much more cortical involvement in the areas, and much more involvement also of anterior cingulate in the middle insular cortex, which we've talked a lot about today. So in the longest relationships, the right anterior and posterior cingulate, the right mid-insular cortex, appear to be the areas that are mostly involved. Now, interestingly enough, why is it the right side? These were all done in right-handed individuals, which gets around the language piece. This is a piece of brain that doesn't do language, but it does affect. So language comes in at age 2 and, like gangbusters in right-handed people, takes over the whole left hemisphere. The left frontal lobe does grammar, the left temporal lobe does your dictionary, does the comprehension piece, translates all of these sounds that I'm saying into some kind of resemblance of English diction and puts it back into thought. The right hemisphere does the prosodic quality, does a lot of the emotional processing of speech, the ability to tell the difference between the sentence, "Did you have a nice day?" and "Did you have a nice day?" Very, very different things. One is a nice inquiry and things are fine. The other, you're in deep shit. Excuse my language. And that processing happens in the right hemisphere. So it's interesting that when you start looking at the neural imaging of attachment, right insular cortex and the right anterior and posterior cingulate are much more involved in their in that kind of material than the left hand side. Now, two other pieces. We talked a little bit earlier today about how the genes get coded and uncoded and how that happens in the membrane. The membrane of the neuron has an effect. It turns out that in these prairie voles who've been studied beyond probably their level of exhaustion, there's in the hormones for oxytocin and vasopressin, which are hormones that are involved in really long-term pair bonding, it turns out that there's a DNA sequence which controls the density of expression of this hormone, the amount of this hormone that shows up, that gets upregulated as the prairie voles get into their monogamous relationship and continues over time. And that same area, there's a similar polymorphism in the human version of the vasopressin gene, suggesting that the same process, in terms of after you go into long-term relationships, and there's much more oxytocin involved and much more vasopressin involved, that upregulation in the gene is actually happening. So here you're actually not just happening at the membrane, but all of a sudden you are changing the DNA that's being expressed in the neuron on a permanent basis. Neurons that fire together not only wire together, they reprogram the DNA that's in there. And I think that's an important take home here. And the last piece here is sort of the fact that this slide is mostly just a teaser. The romantic love is in red, the maternal love is in yellow. And what you can see is that there are some areas of homology where there's overlap. The insular cortex is where this orange, over here on this corner, that orange and red dot where the colors are overlapping, is the right insula. That's where it's located in the brain. The anterior cingulate is that area of red in the upper left-hand corner. Prefrontal cortex is the right. And you can see the maternal love, there's some overlap into multiple different areas, but that it shades from romantic into. And maternal love probably now is probably about the best model we have for what happens as you go into long-term pair bonding. It's structured and it's run over different systems, but that this, so that this morphs over a period of years from a brainstem system into a much more cortical and insular area represented kind of system. Finally, what happens in rejection? And then I'll wrap up. When you look at, there were about 15 people, 10 women and 5 men, who had recently been rejected, and what was showing up in there when they showed the picture, marked increased activity in these dopamine systems an area in the lateral orbital frontal area which is involved in theory of mind, the evaluation of punishers, behavioral adjustment, obsessive compulsive disorder, anger control in cocaine addicts who are coming off of cocaine. This area lights up in people who are rejected. So it's literally, it's a dopamine withdrawal effect, and that level of pain. And down in the brainstem, the nucleus accumbens, the pallidum, and the putame, and the brainstem and basal ganglia, these are areas that get involved in high-risk investment, Wall Street hedge fund kind of shticks. So you get much more radical kind of behavior. You get the people who start stalking. You get this anger piece that starts showing up. You get grief. You get all this obsessional quality to rejection. And that there's literally, not too surprisingly, there's a neuroanatomy to this that shows that that stuff has validity. It's not a story you tell yourself. And the feeling of it coming up from the bottom, the feeling of it being uncontrollable, is actually true, because most of the time when you're in your thought processes, you're out here in the cortex telling stories to yourself. But the stuff that comes up from the brainstem is the stuff that seems to come up and take you over. And so this stuff is real and has a real anatomy to it. And I'm going to switch off. So I said a number of things, perhaps we have a little time for a few questions, and then we should move on to metta.
We have time for about one. But you had your hand up there. First come, first serve, okay?
So my question is around the whole love is blind versus a negativity bias.
Yeah.
Because we're kind of set up to look out for these sticks and protect ourselves, but then when we fall in love, we seem to completely ignore them, which is not protecting ourselves.
You got it.
So, yeah.
That's actually...
Well, my question is...
Why does the body switch from one to the other? It is actually I'm going to go out on a limb here. I think if you know, as the father of three adopted children, if you knew what you were going to get into, you wouldn't do it. To some level, there has to be a level of the denial of the actual cost of having children. If you imagine you were engaging in a love affair and engaging in sexual intercourse, and you're not using birth control, and you're age 20, which is the highest time for female fecundity, that's when you're most likely to get pregnant. If you're engaging in that and you are quite literally putting your life at risk, there has to be a certain amount of chemical denial that shows up. That allows you to go through with that action. And so I think that so women who were capable of that level of denial and then they could proceed to bear children, would have more likelihood of passing that gene on. So this whole idea of the romantic involvement right at the time when you put yourself at greatest exposure and greatest risk, because after fertilization and implantation, for the most part, absent abortion, you're done. You're going to see this one through. There has to be some denial that's built into the system. It's a little post hoc ergo propter hoc. After this, therefore, because of it, back rationalization, back engineering. But I think that piece in there has to be there.
That's great. Well, I want to. So thank you for that. That was quite remarkable. I doubt that anyone has ever presented that material in this setting, for better or worse. But no, mostly for better. And the thing I would just say in passing is that these territories are very controversial. And there are a lot of, the way I look at them as much, I think, is informed by the way the Buddha would look at things, which is in terms of layers or levels of causes that interact with each other in very complex ways. And so when we think about something as intimate as human sexual behavior, our own sexual behavior, let's say, it's useful to appreciate that there are a lot of layers of causes here. There are the kind of primal evolutionary causes that have shaped us over the years. There are genetic causes that are alive and well in our lives today. There are hormonal causes. There are environmental causes. Marx was right in many ways. The economic structuring of things determines things even as intimate in mate preferences. For example, studies have shown that in cultures on the whole that have the greatest degree of economic instability, at that point, women most value strong, protective males and will pay a very high price in terms of personal freedom and pleasure, if you will, to get that. On the other hand, in economies such as in Scandinavia, where there's much more economic stability, women then move typically past that sort of rating of male capacity to be an aggressive warrior who protects them to other, you know, Bob Newhart values. And I will say this as a segue to the Buddha's words on loving kindness. And I've read a lot of this literature because it's been very interesting to me, actually. And it's fraught with peril academically to get into. The one thing that men and women most often choose across most cultures as the leading attribute they care about in their mate selection and their partner is kindness. Mm-hmm. It's kindness.
Right.
They want a kind partner. So on that note, and then really moving to a wrap as close to five as we can possibly get it with a little bit of a practice, I thought I could say a word or two just to, as announcements, then we'll do a little practice for a few minutes, and then I'll ring the bell three times, and that's it for this workshop. And Rick and I will stay here for certainly a few dozen minutes even to talk with you afterward. So do us a favor, don't